Before we start today, there's a video you may have seen on Facebook. A video of a man running around desperately trying to help people. With their shopping, with their bus fare, anything really, he's just offering to be kind. Most people are bemused, but some actually accept the gesture, and both parties sort of revel in the kindness. The makers of that video, kindness.org, are a non-profit who want to know if you'll join their movement for a kinder world. The new site uniquely blends user action, technology, and funds independent, high-quality research to explore the impact of kindness and whether it can be used to solve some of society's most pressing issues. Visit kindness.org to find out more.
Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast and a very special edition of the show today. Today I'm joined by former Premier League referee Howard Webb to talk about his career and his new book, The Man in the Middle, published by Simon & Schuster and available to order now from all good bookshops and websites. Howard, thank you very much for coming on the pod.
My absolute pleasure.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here with you and a chance to talk about my career and obviously this book that's coming out, so thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, no problem. You've had a few busy days with other interviews, I know, so hopefully you've got some interesting questions to take from a different angle for you. But I think the best place to start, because obviously this week Liverpool played Man United at Anfield, it was 0-0, and you took to Twitter to kind of point out that Anthony Taylor, with all the pressure on him, he didn't get the standing ovation he might have deserved for his performance at Anfield. I just wanted to ask him, why do you think it is so hard to highlight the good work that referees do?
Yeah, I mean, I did tweet out after the game that nobody would be speaking about him because he didn't mess up, and That wasn't meant as a way of suggesting that we should speak about referees after a game, because I really don't think we should. It's just that it kind of like gets under my skin a little bit that people do want to talk about him before the game, you know. So we can't really have it both ways, can we? He'd not even blown a whistle and people are all over the media saying, you know, this guy shouldn't be refereeing this particular game. And unnecessary pressure being placed upon him by people who should know better. And then after the game, you know, if he'd made a mistake or messed up, would he continue speaking about him? But because he doesn't, nobody wants to speak about him. So that was really my point. And I had an interesting line in another referee autobiography by Jeff Winter, who's a good friend of mine, but he stated that at the end of his last game at Anfield, he just wondered if the fans knew it was his last game and gave extra applause. And I'm absolutely certain that wasn't the case, Jeff, I'm sorry to say, which I love you, But, you know, I'm absolutely fine with people not talking about, you know, the work that referees do, provided that, you know, they accept that mistakes are made as well and there's nothing more in that than mistakes. If you're going to talk about the negative, then I think we should talk about the positive as well, you know, and recognise when referees do a good job or do contribute positively to a game. And make no mistake, you know, a referee can have a big influence on a match. And my father, what years ago said to me when I first started, he said, just, you know, remember that referees can make a good game a bad one by your performance, but you can't make a bad game a good one. And they were true words. I think there's opportunities to just get across to people that referees do care. They are human beings. We do love the game and we do want to be a positive influence on the game. And I think with, you know, well chosen opportunities to get referees out there and to speak, it will show them in a better light.
Well, one of the things that I love about your book is that I think your humour comes across really well in it. Like I was actually laughing at a lot of points where kind of the jokes in it and just I guess the way you tell your anecdotes, it's a really entertaining read, actually.
Thank you. And thanks.
I've got to ask in terms of what you were just saying then about bad games and good, what do you say is the hardest match you've ever had to referee?
I've had loads of challenging ones and then I've had spells where, you know, everything's fallen into place and it's like, you know, it's a confidence game is refereeing, you know, and sometimes you see the ball really big and, you know, it just all comes very naturally, and other times you're just searching for decisions, and the harder you try, the worse you tend to do, and you have to get out of that rut in the same way players suffer from form dips. I think individually the hardest game has to be the final of the World Cup, because I suppose it's an easy answer, that one, but it's true. I mean, it was the highest profile game I ever did. There's only been 20, I think, now World Cup finals, so 20 referees have taken charge of that game out of millions that have taken to the whistle, and then to be presented with such a difficult game. I mean, nobody really predicted that. We prepped as you normally would, you know, technically and psychologically. We did all the things physically that we would do to perform well at that level, and then we were presented with this game where there was so much physicality, and you're there to do your job to protect the players, but not to overreact. And you want extra certainty on a game like that. If you're gonna ship somebody, if you're gonna send somebody off, in other words, then you know you want to be absolutely clear on it. And it was a difficult balance to strike, quite an exhausting 2 hours.
Do you ever think? Do you go into a match where you can feel the physicality happening? Do you ever think I'm gonna have to give a card earlier in this one just to kind of set a tone, or is it? Do you keep the same standard in every match you officiate?
I learned in my career that you could plan and you could prep and you could expect a certain type of game, but then so many times, you know, you'd be surprised by the game being different to what you expected. I think the key thing was just being ready for anything from the first whistle. Don't try just to, you know, ease your way into a game. Just be ready for something that could happen in the very first few seconds of a game. Don't get caught cold. It happened to me a few times and I learned from it. But be ready to be flexible with your approach. And you know, people talk about consistency as well in refereeing, and they'll say, well, you know, a tackle in the first minute should be dealt with in exactly the same way as a tackle in the 60th minute if it's the same type of tackle. And I've got to say, I totally disagree with that. I mean, you know, it's all about managing the game successfully, and you've got a range of tools as a referee that you can use. You've got your whistle, you've got your red and yellow card, you've got your personality. That's pretty much it, really. And if you go in the first minute with a yellow card for a tackle, that's one where there's some room to manage, some room for subjectivity. I'm not talking about one of these where there's absolutely nowhere to go. It's clearly a yellow card. If it's one of those where you think, yeah, actually, I can manage this, I'll give a word of advice, that might do the trick. You know, if you go straight with the yellow card, you've got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So you've got to give your management a chance in a game. You've got to give players a chance to respond. And also, the game's a really different animal in the 60th minute to what it is in the first. And you know, in the 60th minute, a word of advice might have absolutely no impact whatsoever. You know that, so you're going to have to show a yellow card. So people have to understand that, you know, the referee has to be allowed to manage.
I remember that there's a really good section in, I think, Gianluca Vialli's autobiography about him reading an interview by Pier Luigi Collina about how he prepared for matches by actually studying the players, looking like if it was Ian Robin, he'd know exactly where he's going to cut back to, so he could position himself correctly to see for any fouls. Is that the kind of detail that yourself as a referee went into? Is that quite common practice, or is that a bit of a secret to Kalina's success?
I think, Kalina was quite well known for the level of preparation that he put into his game. I'm not sure that amount of detail is necessarily that helpful. If that's the detail he went into, you know, you're there to do a specific job, and having that kind of a level of detail maybe worked for him. I, like you, Greg, I mean, I was, am still a football anorak, I guess. I mean, I'd watch football as much as I possibly could and read about it, and I'd watch games that involved various clubs that I was about to referee. I would look online at information. I'd try and absorb as much as I could. I'd try and visualise the type of game I was going to be taking charge of, and, of course, the participants in that game to help me prepare. I wouldn't just get the appointment on a Monday, forget all about it, and turn up on a Saturday afternoon with my kit bag. Of course not. I was professional. It was my job. But you know, but again, I think it's focused on the preparation that's useful for you, I think, as a ref, looking at where the danger area is going to be, looking at how teams will set themselves up on set pieces, on corners. I mean, you've got that much to look at on a set piece, on a corner, for example. You know, you've only got one pair of eyes. You need to focus your eyes on an area where you think there's going to be some benefit from looking in that place. So that sort of preparation is useful.
Howard, to what extent do you think that the changes to the laws on grappling, especially in the penalty area during set pieces, is having an effect on some teams? We've seen Stoke City and Leicester City defensively look a bit suspect this season, especially in set pieces. Guys like Wes Morgan, they're not the most gifted with pace, and I think in the past maybe they tried to get a grab of their of attackers they were marking. Do you think that's hampered them this season?
So, I mean, this year we've seen a re-emphasis on certain aspects in the Premier League particularly, but also in the Football League, which is, you know, refereed by people that come from the same organisation, the Professional Game Match Officials Limited. The Premier League referees are professional people who work for that organisation. And every year, several times a year, the stakeholders get in a room together. The stakeholders being the clubs, the leagues, the FA, the referees, the managers, and they talk about what they think is topical and what needs to be looked at within the game. And I think for quite some time there's been a feeling that probably we need to get a little bit tighter on dissent and also play behaviour and also holding in the penalty area. You know, there's been a lot of grappling left unchecked in the penalty area, particularly at set pieces. So these were the things that the stakeholders decided they'd deal with. It wasn't just the referees who thought, you know, that's what we want to do. It's no, they don't exist in silos. They do talk to each other. And we don't referee for referee's sake. We referee the game, you know, for the game and for the participants and the other stakeholders. So the referees were told, look, this year, be more vigilant, be proactive on holding and be strong. If the players don't heed your warnings, then make sure you get in there and deal with it, provided that you see it, of course, in the first place, like we've talked about, be vigilant and then take action. And I think it has had an effect. It has made defenders, particularly defenders, I mean, attackers can foul in the penalty area as well, of course, but and they can block and often do, but you know, it's made defenders think a little bit about the way that they need to defend. And hopefully we're seeing less instances of defenders not defending properly, not looking at the ball, paying only attention to the opponent and using unfair methods to gain an advantage when defending. We need to see a bit more consistency in the referees. There's too much, it's too far a gap between what some people on that list determine as worthy of intervention and what others consider worthy. My personal opinion is that they need to be looking for the obvious stuff, not the really minor stuff that has no impact on the passage of play. That's going to be part and parcel of a crowded penalty area anywhere where players are jostling. Let's go for the ones that have a clear impact on the opponent, where players are clearly not looking at the ball, where they've got one intention to block their opponent, to hold their opponent, to gain that unfair advantage with clear physicality. They're the ones that you should be looking at, and also that gives consistency, because if you start looking for the really small, minor tugs, minor bits of contact, you're going to set yourself up for a fall as a ref, because you're going to miss some of those at the other end.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't see everything. So go for the clear stuff that people say, you know something, fair enough, you had no choice but to penalise that. On the other aspect, on dissent, I've got to congratulate the lads. I think they're doing a good job this season. They've maintained their line. You know, we've had eight Premier League rounds so far this season, and we've had, I think, 45 yellow cards for dissent this season so far. That's in 8 rounds. Last year we had 60 yellow cards in 38 rounds. So you can see we're very soon going to be at the level we were at last year in the first quarter of the season. So I've got to say, you know, it's something that they've taken on board. The refs, they've stuck at it. The players and the managers were told pre-season, guys, if you misbehave, you're going to be dealt with strongly. You hear coaches post-match talking about the messages that were given pre-season. And, you know, hopefully you'll see a reduction in dissent. And that will give a good example to younger players up and down the country.
I've got to ask, which players gave you the most trouble on the field when you were a referee?
Oh, there were quite a few who were prepared to share their opinion. I mean, the players I didn't like were the ones who would give an opinion but did not want to engage with you at all. They just wanted to give you, you know, they'd look at you like there was something that they'd trod in. They'd say something, not particularly abusive, but just, you know, just give you a look and say something quite disdainful and then not want to engage in my opinion whatsoever. I mean, again, nothing against individual players, but I mean, players like Fernando Torres was like that. You know, when his form dipped, he became quite difficult to manage. You know, he would look at you like, you know, and shrug his shoulders and, you know, not an anti-Spanish thing, this, by the way, but Cesc Fabregas was a similar sort of player. He wouldn't want to engage with me as the ref, particularly. Craig Bellamy was really hard work. He was different. He was just more. I've talked this week about psychological warfare with Craig. It was more like that with him. He would, you know, but I think he looked for an advantage, whether it be a weakness in the ref, a weakness in a fullback. He tried to impose himself on the game and you know, to get an advantage. Other players who you might think were difficult. You know, Joey Barton's name gets mentioned quite a lot. Robbie Savage, of course, these firebrand kind of players. Actually, they wore the heart on the sleeve. They had personality, but they allowed you to have personality on the field as a ref as well. So you could engage in some dialogue, and you know, people have, you know, turned away from the word banter, but in some ways that's what it was. You know, but it was healthy and it was okay, and you know, we could develop a rapport on the pitch.
We talked about dissent earlier, but I guess in the heat of the battle, as it were, when the adrenaline's pumping. Do referees kind of allow some players that, you know, as you say, wear the heart on the sleeve, to not get away with saying certain things, but let's say Robbie Savage or Joey Barton says something a bit out of turn, but would you maybe let it pass because you know what their character's like and you know that they maybe don't mean it in the sense that it could be taken?
I think with any player, you know, with any player, you understand that football evokes emotion and reaction, and provided that it's not beyond the sort of like the level of acceptability, then referees will be prepared to take it. You know, referees are not shrinking violets; they're grown men with broad shoulders and thick skin, and you know, and they'll accept that they'll make a mistake from time to time. And if somebody came up to me and said, "That's a shocking decision, ref or Howard or whatever," I wouldn't take an exception to that.
Yeah.
It depends what context it's in, how it's said, and what's said, and you take it case by case, based on what all those factors and the individual personality of the player comes into it in terms of you need to manage a player, but you try to make sure you're fair across the board because just because somebody's normally a decent guy and then says something that you wouldn't expect from them doesn't mean you treat them any more harsh than somebody would be chirping away all game. So you need to be fair and proper. There's some players that you need to keep an eye on because they respond to constant encouragement. You know, Luis Suarez was like that. You know, if you kept an eye on Luis Suarez, just, you know, monitoring him, making sure that he's okay, you know, having a little chat to him now and again, you okay, Luis, a little thumbs up. He'd respond to that. He'd feel like you were managing him in a positive way. If you just dismissed him and turned your shoulders, and didn't want to engage with him, then he'd probably think, well, if that's the case, then I'll just do what I want to do, sort of thing. So a bit like, I don't like comparing referees to school teachers, but not there's anything wrong with school teachers, and some make very good referees, but it's a bit like, a teacher will know the personalities of the people in their class, a good teacher will, and will know how to get the best out of those kids. And the same on the field, you know how to get the best response out of players to keep them onside.
Do you ever find, because obviously you're rather a tall fellow, do you ever find that your actual frame on the pitch helped you in terms of how you control players? Did they respect you more because you're quite an imposing figure?
I was often the biggest person on the pitch. I mean, weight-wise, I mean, I was nearly 100 kilos, and you don't get 100-kilo footballers, and I was over 6'2", so quite a physically imposing guy. Not that you need to be a successful ref. One of the best refs we've seen in this country was a little guy called Paul Durkin, who was, a really talented and imposing guy, and only standing at 5'7" or something, so you don't have to be huge. But I guess in those heated moments, when I extended my arms out and made it obvious that I wasn't wanting to be surrounded, not that you can hit somebody because you're 6'2". I can't do anything more than a 5'7" guy can in that respect. But maybe psychologically it has an impact, and they think, this guy is not somebody we want to mess with.
I did like the anecdote about Uriah Rennie having to separate the... was it Mark Halsey in that one?
Yeah, and Graham Paul having quite a heated... heated altercation, and Uriah stepped in as the peacemaker. Uriah was a big guy. I mean, big thighs. Everything about him was big. He wasn't somebody that you'd want to upset.
But I just go back to the point on the laws and checking what's happening in a game. What are your thoughts on the expanded roles of fourth officials and the introduction of video technology? We've seen in Holland now they're starting to trial that actually in their competitive fixtures. Do you think videos are a tool for refs, or are there any drawbacks to that kind of technology?
There's loads of potential drawbacks, but I would state at the very start of this answer that my position is one of support for the introduction of trials. I think, we will never move the argument forward unless we try it. And there's loads and loads of pitfalls ahead before we get to a position where we, as a game, come to an agreed sort of protocol as to how it should work. And that protocol should include what we look at on video, when we look at it, who looks at it and how we look at it and all those sort of things. Because the game of football is such a flowing, high-tempo game that doesn't have as many natural stoppages as some of the other sports that have been able to embrace technology. It presents its own challenges. And I've worked now for over a season now for BT Sport as a match analyst, and I've covered over 75 games last year, another dozen this year, and there's probably nobody better that understands some of the potential difficulties of how to come to a conclusive answer from a TV outside broadcast van or wherever that additional assistant or that video assistant might be. But there are some clear benefits as well. It would certainly cut out those humdinging errors that people remember in years to come. I think most referees would welcome the opportunity to have some assistance. I think if we'd have offered Anthony Taylor, who refereed Liverpool Manchester United on Monday, the chance to use video technology, if I'd have phoned him 2 hours before the game and said, "Would you like me to be looking down a video camera, be able to speak to you, just to back up your calls or give you some advice and guidance?" I'm sure he would have said, "I'd love it." But it's just knowing how you're going to do it. If the game isn't stopped immediately after an appeal, you know, how long do you get to look at that before you come to a conclusion that it's maybe inconclusive? What happens if something else happens in the time that the video assistant is reviewing that situation? Who's going to review the next one?
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes how do you even know that a situation's happened? I mean, the referee, if he's the guy that instigates the review, sometimes on the pitch you didn't even know that some handball, for example, might have been so blindside that you didn't even, you wouldn't even ask for the review because you didn't know it happened. So you'd probably have to say you can't just rely on the on-field referee to instigate the review. There'd have to be an element of the guy in the van, if that's the way we do it, coming in to help. But all these things need ironing out, and there's an awful lot of work to be done before we get to a position where we say that is something that's enhanced the game.
Is there any threat to the authority of the referee as he is on the pitch if you're going to go to the video guy to kind of call things out that the referee might not have seen? Is that a danger that you're going to take away from the referee, is that this kind of a central figure who's controlling that match?
There is a danger. I mean, there's certainly a benefit that the referee's authority will be enhanced if it's done well, in that the players will accept the decision much more readily, knowing that it's been validated by somebody who's had a chance to look at it again. Mm. In the same way that the referee's authority is enhanced by the goal line decision system. You know, the referee gets an indication that the ball's over the line or not for a goal, and nobody challenges that decision. We saw, I think it was on Tuesday night, we saw Bayer Leverkusen play against Tottenham, and Javier Hernandez thought he'd scored, and Hugo Lloris made a great save and stopped it on the line just. And, you know, okay, Hernandez reacted because he thought it was in, but the technology was there, and, you know, the referee was able to say, look, it's not a goal. And the players accept it and get on with it and think, yeah, fine, and the referee has loved that. But if you go too far with it, if you start checking every throw in, every corner, every goal kick, suddenly the referee on the middle is just a guy who's carrying out the instructions of the referee in the van.
Yeah.
Almost like a remote control ref. and it's tough, again, because if you say, okay, we'll not do that, we'll not have the referee in the van giving the direction, we'll use the guy on the pitch to give to ask for the referral. You know, sometimes I'd give a yellow card out and it would look like a stonewall, bog standard yellow card. And when I see it again on TV from a few different degrees of angle, it could look like a red card.
Yeah.
So the referee on the pitch would probably play it safe and ask for every yellow card to be checked and every penalty appeal to be checked and every penalty given to be checked. You know what I mean? To be on the safe side. So then you start to throw it back to the video man to say, okay, you just check everything.
Goes to NFL then almost with the breakage in time and stuff like that. Yeah,
and you just need to be careful. We need some clear direction about who instigates the check, how it's done, and what is checked. And if we get a situation where the referee gives a corner by mistake, should have been a goal kick, and the corner comes in and the team scores from the corner, we have to say, okay, that could have been sorted out by video technology. But actually, we don't check corners and goal kicks. We don't check throw-ins. Anything can lead to a goal.
Yeah.
We have to accept it's done for the major incidents. We have to accept it doesn't get us to 100% accuracy. It just gets us a bit closer. And also, what is 100% accuracy, Greg? You know, you and I might come to different conclusions about a penalty. There was a penalty appeal last night. I got some stick on Twitter about it. I think it was it Jeremy Mathieu who came on as a sub for Barca? The ball hit his arm. From across by Sterling. I think that was the defender. I can't be certain. Anyway, but he's turning. As he turns, gravity means his arms come out, if you like, you know, or not gravity, but, you know, the physical laws means your arms come out as you turn your body. And that's what happened, the ball at his arm. I didn't think it was a penalty. It was from short distance. You know, quite a few fans on Twitter thought it should have been. You might have thought it should have been. Other referees might have thought it should have been. It's sometimes a subjective call. I'm not saying, I would never say I'm right about everything. I'm clearly not. I'm just somebody who's learnt the laws of the game, been on the pitch many, many times, been to dozens and dozens of seminars looking at incidents. So I'm better placed to understand the sort of like the considerations that referees give when they're making a decision than the average guy in the street.
We've talked a little bit about the technical details there, maybe some of the critical aspects of refereeing, but I want to bring it back to the positive, the art of refereeing, if you will. We've seen guys like Mike Dean. He's kind of become a bit of a celebrity on Twitter for his celebration of his own giving of advantage. I just want to ask, as a referee, I know in your book you said you were officiating a match as a police officer once and you missed a flare being thrown onto the pitch because you were appreciating the advantage played by the referee that day. Do referees see advantages like the art of your trade, and how do you appreciate it as a referee watching now from the sidelines?
Well, I'm impressed that you've read the book in such detail. It's true, yeah. And I got, in fact, you know, coming down for this interview on the train, I from Sheffield, I sat on the train, and who sat opposite me but the superintendent, who's now retired, who was in charge as silver commander of that Sheffield derby at Bramall Lane. And we were talking about why I was coming down to London, and he reminded me of that. He said, do you remember the time when you were getting paid to be a policeman and you were watching the game as a fan? As that young Sheffield Wednesday fan got hit by a flare. The problem is you end up watching the game through referee's eyes and not appreciating the game maybe as you would have done as a fan, apart from two occasions. If I'm watching England, I'm very much a fan. I was desperately disappointed by the way it turned out in the summer. And also if I'm watching my team, which is Rotherham United, who actually fired their manager this week, Alan Stubbs, which I'm disappointed about the way it's worked out. I think it's the right decision, unfortunately, that Alan should move on. But when I'm watching the club that I love and support and always have done, then I'm very much a football fan, getting annoyed, kicking every ball, having a shout at the ref if I don't think he's getting all the time wasting by the opponents. Mm. And football's got this amazing ability to make rational, intelligent, sane, sensible people become loony. And I would put myself in that category. When it comes to their team, I remember I do some consultancy work in Saudi Arabia, and I was flying from Heathrow out to Riyadh, sat next to an airline pilot from Saudi Arabia who'd been doing some simulator training with the Royal Air Force at Bryce Norton. Sensible, intelligent, smart guy. Great conversation for the first hour about his role in the Saudi Air Force. And then suddenly it turned to football, and it's just as though like he'd gone to the toilet on the plane and his twin brother had sat down, right? It's a totally different character. That's what it does. People just lose their mind when it comes to football, and club football particularly, more than international football. People, particularly here in this country, in England, love their clubs more than anything else.
I know we are running down on our time now, so just a couple more questions for you. As you say, you are a Rotherham fan, and in the book you talk about how when you were going to do your first matches in league football, you were very conscious of the weight that decisions referees make can have. The one bad decision could create a domino effect that could lead to people losing their jobs, clubs getting relegated, all the rest of it. So have you ever had to make a decision that's kind of gone against your instincts as a fan? Like, you've seen it happen, thinking, oh, this is gonna cause some collateral damage, maybe.
I think the one that stands out was in 2006, the FA Cup final was West Ham against Liverpool. Finished 3-3, didn't it? Went to penalties. I mean, Steven Gerrard scored a really nice goal late on. And I refereed the same two teams in the league 2 weeks before at Upton Park. And I thought, take it nice and steady, Howard. You know what I mean? These players here are going to be at Wembley in 2 weeks. Nothing stupid. And then with 10 minutes to go, Hayden Mullins and Luis Garcia from West Ham and Liverpool, respectively, got involved in an altercation and threw a couple of slaps. I remember thinking, right, do I send them off or not? I should send them off. It's sending off offences. If I send them off, they're going to miss the FA Cup final. If I don't, then they complain it, but I'll get heavily penalised for not doing my job. And I sent them off. I was determined that I was going to be successful and get to the top, and I sent them off. And, was it the right thing to do? It was from a laws of the game point of view, but I think later on in my career, I might have just taken the hit probably and just thought, think of it as a human being, as a football fan. And then also, as Iniesta scored in the World Cup final with 3 minutes to go, he took his shirt off. And I thought to myself, my goodness, I've had 13 yellow cards in this game already. I'm pretty almost sure that number 6 for Spain is probably already on my card. I couldn't remember for certain with so many cards. And I would have had to have sent him off. And luckily, when I looked down on my card, there was no number 6 for Spain written down. I thought, thank goodness. And I didn't have to send him off, because as a football fan, it would have hurt me to send off the winning goal scorer in a World Cup final for something like taking his shirt off.
Yeah.
But, it's something you have to do. You've got no choice.
That brings us to our very final question. And you might have answered there in the way you talked about Iniesta there. But if you were to be in control of the laws of the game for one day and you could take one rule out and put one rule in, what would be the one you take out and what would be the one you'd put in?
I think that we've seen some real steps forward with the laws of the game being improved in the last couple of the last year, really. I mean, there was a big overhaul. So, for example, something that used to get under my skin, players who got tackled with yellow card offences. So everybody's acknowledging it's a bad foul and had to have treatment, had to leave the field of play. And then that was maybe the penalty taker who's had to go off, or the free kick specialist. Now they can stay on the pitch. So that's a really good step forward, isn't it, I think. I'm not sure that... We talked about the taking off of the shirt. And I was asked about this on BT Sport. Why does it need to be a yellow card? I don't think it really does, does it? You know, if it's done in a provocative way, an offensive way, then I would say, yeah, make that a yellow card. But we're talking about celebrating a goal, for goodness sake. You know, the greatest thing you can do in football, isn't it? And it creates great emotions. I'm not sure why players won't take the shirt off, to be honest, but I would take that one away. And what would I introduce? And we've touched upon this as well. I would certainly introduce, as soon as possible, a thorough trial of video technology so that we can get to a situation where we can help the guy in the pitch, who's often the only guy in the world who hasn't had, because people in the stands have got phones now, they can see situations back, the guy that counts hasn't had a replay. And I remember sitting there back in 2009 in a World Cup playoff between France and Spain. I was at France and Ireland. I was at home watching Thierry Henry handle the ball, cross it to William Gallas, who scored to knock Ireland out of the World Cup. Not only that, my mate refereeing the game from Sweden, Martin Hansen, got knocked out as well because he didn't go to the World Cup to referee a game either because of that handling of the ball. And me and my 8-year-old lad at the time sat on the sofa. We could see it within 10 seconds. And I thought, how ridiculous that the guy on the pitch, I wanted to ring him. I wanted to get my mobile phone out and give him a call and say, Martin, disallow the goal. He didn't have his phone with him, but you know, I think the sooner we get that in, the better.
Howard, thank you very much for that chat. It's been absolutely fascinating speaking to you. I believe The Man in the Middle is out today, 20th of October, available at all good bookshops and websites, published on Simon & Schuster. And I believe Joanne Lake, wife of Paul Lake, is the ghostwriter on that.
Yeah, and a big thank you and acknowledgement to Jo, really talented lady. We had some wonderful interviews to draw out the stories. She's brought them to life. She wrote the book for Paul Lake, who was a classy player at Manchester City and suffered a terrible injury which he never quite recovered from. He would have had a great career, international career, and I got to know Paul really well as well and the family. So it's been a really good experience doing the book. I hope people enjoy it. I hope it maybe opens up, you know, some real insight into the life of a football referee, me as a person as well, and I really hope people enjoy it, and thank you for your support, Greg.
No problem. Thank you for coming on. Please join us again for another Squawker Talker podcast on Monday, when Nick English will be hosting and reviewing all the action in the Premier League and Europe.